Today is Wednesday, February 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. U.S. officials say the Biden administration has approved sending troops into Eastern Europe and says it's not to blame for the standoff over Ukraine.
When the fox is screaming from the top of the hen house that he's scared of the chickens, which is essentially what they're doing, that fear isn't reported as a statement of fact.
As the Winter Olympics open, scientists warn climate change could hurt future games. One snowboarder says Beijing's conditions are good.
The snow is actually really amazing, the man-made stuff.
And Tonga goes into COVID lockdown. We'll have these stories and more next. Multiple news agencies are reporting that U.S. President Joe Biden has approved deploying 2,000 U.S. troops to Poland and Germany and repositioning some 1,000 troops already in Europe to Romania. This comes after Tuesday's joint news conference with Hungary's prime minister, in which Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the U.S. and NATO of ignoring Russia's chief security demands. Putin also said he's willing to talk more to lower tensions over Ukraine. It's the first time Putin spoke about the Ukraine standoff in more than a month. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked if the Biden administration empathizes with Putin's claims that his concerns are not being addressed.
In our view, do we have sympathy? I mean, this is, you know, Secretary Blinken has used some of these analogies in the past, but when the fox is screaming from the top of the hen house that he's scared of the chickens, which is essentially what they're doing, that fear isn't reported as a statement of fact.
That was White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. I asked VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain if she heard anything new in Putin's remarks.
Yes, Carol. I mean, what's been making the headlines is that the U.S. and NATO have ignored Russia's fundamental concerns about security concerns, about Ukraine being allowed at some point to join NATO, and about NATO military exercises in Eastern Europe. But he also said he had a new line that I hadn't heard before, that he said the U.S. is using Ukraine as a tool in its efforts to contain Russia. And he said Washington may try to draw Russia into a military conflict and force its allies in Europe to impose the tough sanctions that the U.S. has been talking about. So for me, this was new that he was saying, you know, here Russia has 100,000 troops amassed along the Ukraine border, and now he's blaming the U.S. for trying to draw Russia into a conflict. And he also said something that I hadn't heard before. He said Ukrainians and backed by the U.S. and the West may try to retake the Crimea Peninsula, which, of course, Russia illegally annexed. Resulting in a war that is still going on in eastern Ukraine that has killed some 14,000 people.
And about that, with Crimea, where it stands, like you said, that land still remains under Russian control now, and it was Ukrainian territory.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that is what basically so many now in the West fear that Putin is doing again, that he's rewriting borders in Europe by force. Basically, you know, he went in and took that part of Crimea, illegally annexed, and the West is still calling on Putin to withdraw forces there and has been backing proxy forces, pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, and there is a long, long simmering conflict there.
Are any more talks scheduled this week between Russian and U.S. diplomats, or are they continuing, I should say, as we speak?
No, there are no new talks so far set up for this week with the U.S. We had Secretary Blinken speaking with Lavrov on Tuesday, and Blinken was calling for an immediate de-escalation for Russia to start pulling some of those troops back. We do have Putin is set to speak with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and Putin has said that French President Emmanuel Macron may visit Moscow soon. But all those are still in the works.
Has the U.S. sent any military equipment so far to Ukraine since the standoff began?
The U.S. has sent more than $650 million in military equipment to Ukraine over the past year, more than at any other time. And it's just recently is delivering more defense equipment a couple of times a week. And to get it there quickly, the U.S. has also authorized its NATO allies to provide equipment. And then there's been U.S.-made missiles. Estonia is sending Javelin anti-armor missiles. Latvia and Lithuania are sending Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. And these things are, we see them arriving in Kyiv.
And what about U.S. troops? Are they still on standby as far as you know?
Yes. To my knowledge, the troops are still on standby. It's not a huge number of troops, and they are just have been put on alert so that they could be ready to go quickly, not to Ukraine, but to NATO deployments in Eastern Europe.
That is VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain speaking with me on Wednesday. As Beijing prepares for the opening of the Winter Olympics later this week, scientists are warning that the future of the Games is under threat due to climate change. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Zhang Jiakou, 200 kilometers northwest of Beijing, will host freestyle skiing and snowboarding, cross-country skiing and ski jumping. The problem is, it rarely snows. So for several weeks, snow machines have been churning out artificial snow. Site manager Jacques Fournier has a difficult job.
Here is no humidity, it's very dry, and it's a lot of wind.
For the first time, the Beijing Winter Olympics will use almost 100% artificial snow. But a new report warns athletes' safety could be at risk. Madeleine Orr, a sports ecologist at Britain's Loughborough University, is a co-author of the report.
In sports like biathlon, or cross-country skiing, or any of the freestyle events where an athlete is flinging themselves into the air, flipping around and falling, you would want the surface to be a little softer. And the problem with artificial snow is that it's about 70% ice compared to natural snow, which is about 30% ice. And so the surface is much, much harder.
American snowboarder Taylor Gold is preparing for Beijing. During his first Olympics in the Russian resort of Sochi in 2014, he recalls the halfpipe melting.
They were spraying some chemicals on it to try to get it to stay in shape, but if you go back and watch that event, it's clear it was really warm. It was not ideal for snowboarding.
Critics say the climate of both Sochi and Beijing are unsuitable to host the Winter Olympics. But even high-altitude mountain ski resorts that have traditionally hosted the Games are at risk because of climate change. Again, Madeleine Orr.
The northeast of the U.S., for example, eastern Canada, we are losing significant amounts of snow there. And then in places like the Rockies and the Alps, we just don't have quite as much as we used to. So the challenge moving forward is going to be, where can we put these events? And with the Winter Olympics, we're already kind of there.
Using artificial snow also causes environmental damage.
Previous research has shown that that can be damaging to local wildlife. But we also expect that, you know, when you're creating that much snow, the energy usage is extraordinary. The amount of water is extraordinary. In this Olympics, we're expecting 49 million gallons of water to be used.
The Chinese organizers insist the Games will be carbon neutral. All venues are expected to be powered by renewable energy. Ice rinks will use natural CO2 technology for cooling instead of ozone-damaging hydrofluorocarbons. And some athletes prefer artificial snow. Among them, Zoe Sadowski-Sinnott, a New Zealander downhill snowboarder.
The snow is actually really amazing, the man-made stuff. And I think because of how cold it is, it's really, you have to be really aggressive with how you ride, but you know, you just have to adapt.
Olympic organizers will also have to adapt. The Loughborough University report warns that by 2050, fewer than half of the resorts that have hosted the Winter Olympics up till now will have viable snowfall. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett repeated previous remarks this week in which he stressed that he would never meet with Palestinian negotiators, namely Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. He added, "I reject the creation of a Palestinian state. I will never allow carrying out political talks on the borders." Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. Shanawi about whether Bennett's position could impede any attempt to revive the peace talks.
The statements, frankly, of the Israeli prime minister are not surprising at all. This has been his legacy all along as a politician. It's been his position and the position of his affiliates. He's very close to the militant and radical settlers. He headed different organizations relevant to them. So there is absolutely no surprise in his position. The surprise is the fact that he is the prime minister of Israel at this time, and the fact that this administration has a totally different position, totally opposed to the ideas that were articulated by Mr. Bennett. Now, when you look, for example, at the statement today by the State Department, the fact that the Secretary of State, Blinken, called Abu Mazen, Mr. Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, to talk with him about improving relations between the U.S. and the Palestinians, which has improved, actually, since the beginning of this administration, but to continue to focus on that with the declared objective, as the Secretary of State said, or the statement from the State Department indicated, that the Palestinians and the Israelis alike deserve to live safely and securely and enjoy, and I'm quoting the State Department, equal measures of security, freedom, and prosperity. The question that begs to be answered, how can you pursue freedom and prosperity under Israeli occupation? It can't be done. So if the current government is unable to break that ideological deadline, and if Mr. Bennett insists on continuing his position, of course, hiding behind the fig leaf that his government is somewhat too weak and that any overture toward the Palestinians will bring it down, if that's the coalition, the best coalition that Israel could come up with, then neither Israel nor the Palestinians are going to have peace, and neither the U.S. is going to have the option that this administration has made one of its main objectives in the region to resume some sort of the peace negotiations process in the region.
There were meetings between Abbas and Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz and Foreign Minister Yair Lapid on resuming security cooperation between the two sides. However, Bennett stated the two ministers do not have any power to discuss the political issue with the Palestinians. What do you make of that?
I think these meetings are a futile attempt to pacify the Palestinian side, aside from the gesture itself, which was essentially, I think it wasn't an Israeli gesture. I think it was an American gesture toward the Palestinians. The meeting took place at the urging of administration. And considering the fact that the meeting took place in the context of those statements by the prime minister, the meeting doesn't make sense. Israel spent most of its time trying to avoid any spin whatsoever inside Israel that this was a step toward peace, denying that it has anything to do with political negotiations, anything to do with borders, anything to do with Palestinian rights, and instead that it was simply a coordination of security-related issues. And even though they took some measures, again, under duress, under U.S. pressure, whether it's basically providing the PA with some of the funds that Israel was withholding from Palestinian tax revenues, legalizing the status of at least 9,000 to 10,000 Palestinian residents. And so all these steps are much ado about nothing. You know, so when you go back to the American objective to bring peace closer, one looks at these meetings, whether with foreign minister or whether with the defense minister or any other Israeli official meeting with counterparts on the Palestinian side, and notice at the same time that we are not one millimeter closer to peace, one has to question the validity of these meetings.
That was Khalil Jashan, president of the Arab Center in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Tonga went into COVID-19 lockdown on Wednesday as it recovers from last month's devastating volcanic eruption and tsunami waves. The island nation has reported two cases of coronavirus after previously recording just a single infection last October. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has that story.
Two dock workers handling humanitarian aid in Tonga have tested positive for COVID-19. The international relief effort is like no other as Tonga recovers from one disaster while trying to avoid another. It has strict no-contact protocols that act as a barrier to prevent transmission of the new coronavirus from foreign navy ships and aircraft to the Tongan people. But those defences appear to have been breached, and the Pacific archipelago will go into lockdown for at least 2 days starting Wednesday. Australia's Navy vessel HMAS Adelaide unloaded supplies last week, despite a coronavirus outbreak that infected more than 20 of its crew. Britain, France, New Zealand and the United States have also been delivering essential supplies. Tongan journalist Marion Kupu told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that two infected port staff had worked closely with aid shipments.
We're talking about people who are there on first hand when we have ships or aircraft coming into Tonga, offloading cargoes, and also they're the front line. These are the first person, first contact with anything landing here in Tonga. We just need to protect their identity while they work on trying to find or to trace where they've been in the past few days.
Tonga has a population of just over 100,000. It closed its borders in early 2020 as the coronavirus pandemic swept the globe. Since then, the island nation has diagnosed just one case of COVID-19 in a man who returned from New Zealand in October last year and has since fully recovered. The volcanic blast, 65 kilometres north of the Tongan capital of Nuku'alofa, was one of the biggest recorded in decades, generating massive tsunami waves and blanketing the island nation in toxic ash. Three people died. The United Nations said last week that drinking water remained the main challenge facing Tonga. An undersea communications cable that connects the archipelago to the rest of the world was damaged in the volcanic eruption. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Residents in Guinea-Bissau cautiously returned to normal life on Wednesday after a failed coup attempt on Tuesday. At least six people were killed in the effort to overthrow President Umaro Sissoco Embalo. The dead include four assailants and two members of the presidential guard, according to state radio. Embalo had announced on Tuesday night that the situation was under control after gunfire rang out for more than 5 hours near a government compound where he was holding a cabinet meeting. The West African nation has seen 10 coups or attempted coups since 1974. U.S. President Joe Biden is committing to reduce the cancer death rate by 50% over the next 25 years in a so-called Moonshot Initiative. The program began while he was vice president in the Obama administration. Biden's eldest son, Beau, died from brain cancer in 2015. The James Webb Space Telescope, the most powerful telescope ever built, has arrived at its destination around Lagrange Point 2, or what's known as L2. It's the place where the telescope is at zero gravity between the Earth and the Sun. The mission operations team is now moving through a critical number of steps, like powering on the instruments and getting ready to capture the first images on Webb's primary camera. If all goes as planned, the photos will give scientists clues about the origins of the universe. Dr. Klaus Pentapadon, project director of the Webb Telescope at the Space Telescope Science Institute, says there are 18 different segments that are looking in slightly different directions.
It's like the telescope is a bit cross-eyed, right? So we actually, when we point to a star, we see 18 images of that star. So the first step is actually to find all those 18 images of that star so we know where each segment is looking. And we turn each segment so that we can put that star into one spot. It's like, you know, seeing straight instead of seeing cross-eyed. That's the first step. And then we can focus.
And since it's so far out there, I imagine one little tinkering takes a long time to reach the telescope, right?
Yeah, it's about five light seconds away. So the radio signal up to the telescope takes about 5 seconds to get there. And then it takes 5 seconds for it to respond back to us. So a 10-second round trip. No. But still, I mean, it's a noticeable delay.
What kind of celestial images do you plan to observe?
So the observatory, it's what's called a general-purpose astrophysical observatory. So it's going to touch almost every field of astrophysics. It was originally designed to see the very first galaxies in the universe. So that's certainly an important part of it. But it'll take images of galaxies, of young stars still coming out of their dusty cocoons. There will be observations of exoplanets or planets around other solar systems, and so on. So it's really almost everything like we're used to from the Hubble Space Telescope. It will be very similar in that sense.
And I imagine the Hubble, it's going to
We hope so, and we think so. Certainly, the expectation is that it will be similar in many ways. It will also be different, right? Because again, Webb works in the infrared light. So these are light that is too red for the human eye to see it. It's redder than red. And so it's a different type of light. So things will look different, but we expect to have at least as many detail and sharpness as Hubble did.
VOA is celebrating its 80th anniversary this month, and one of VOA's longest-serving staffers is senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. He's with the English to Africa division. In part two of our conversation, Mohammed remembers several high points of his career, including his reporting trip in 1994 to Gaza and Jerusalem, where he covered the start of Palestinian autonomy.
Another fond memory is co-hosting a TV program called Dialogue with the West in 1996-1997. Where President Bill Clinton spoke directly to our Arab audience, starting his statement with greetings to the audience of Dialogue with the West. That was the first time an American president speaking directly to the audience.
That's totally amazing. So was that program live when President Clinton came on?
The program was live, but the statement was taped. And the reason for that is we have to translate over.
I see. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you had a huge audience for that one.
That was reaching, according to research, 35 million. And the program won a VOA Meritorious Honor Award of Outstanding Creativity.
Do you think some of those memories that you just outlined, I think at least, that anything different, that you may have that kind of impact?
Actually, the name of the program was Dialogue with the West, bringing together officials from the Arab world, officials from the United States, talking about issues and political problems that connects the two worlds. And I met a prominent journalist in Egypt one time, and he said, Mohammed, if you didn't do anything in your life except this program, that would be enough, because it really was, people were glued to TV sets every Friday when we present this program. So that was a hit.
That's just great. VOA has always had a special relationship with the U.S. State Department, and you've had a personal experience with that. Can you share some of those experiences with us?
Yes, Carol. When VOA Arabic was shut down in 2002, I began to host a TV program for State Department called Global Exchange, which used satellite connection with U.S. embassies in the Arab world. I would pick a topic related to U.S. policy in the region and discuss it briefly with a State Department official, then let Arab journalists at different U.S. embassies pose their questions to the American official. Through such a dialogue, the State Department managed to reach readers and audiences of those journalists who publish or broadcast the dialogue the following day or two. In 2003, State Department sent me to Chad for a week to train 35 Chadian Arabic-speaking journalists on reporting for radio, television, and print media. The embassy wrote back to Washington saying, the trainer was excellent. In addition to being an effective speaker and trainer, he was an outstanding cultural ambassador for the U.S.
I mean, that's got to be rewarding, because you know that you're having an impact, and you know that you're making a difference for the future, the next generation of journalists.
Yeah, that's why in 2004, State Department asked VOA to detail me for 15 months to serve as a senior TV producer at the Office of Broadcast Services at State Department. With camera crews, I traveled to several cities in America featuring Arab American artists in New York and Hollywood, First Arab American Museum in Detroit, Arab American festivals, success stories among the Arab community individuals, and some aspects of American life like soccer mom and do-it-yourself tradition.
That was VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. He was speaking with me on VOA's 80th anniversary. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team here, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.